Welcome back to Techonomics, a show that mashes up tech topics and the economy at large. I am your host, Jason Middleton. For this segment, we try to take the jitters out of the anxiety that most of us face when it comes to our own household budgets and, frankly, our online purchasing. We recently had a behavioral scientist slash economist slash author on Techonomics to discuss his new book, Money Anxiety, How Financial Uncertainty Changes Consumer Behavior and the Economy.
When people are more nervous, obviously, especially the individual investors tend to trade more and sell if they feel that things are not going well.
So this time around, we have a consumer behavioral psychologist to help unpack the same anxiety at a level we all experience in our own checking accounts and daily lives.
Okay, Kit Yarrow, author of Decoding the New Consumer Mind, and or if you want to use a consumer psychologist, professor at Golden Gate University.
Right on. Kit, friend of the show, we haven't had you on in a while. And the reason we wanted to speak with you this week is because last week we had somebody on who had done a study, a behavioral economic study, and he wrote a book about it called Money Anxiety and how that's affecting politics. And his research also went into a more of a zeitgeist type of thing. But we thought maybe a little more human approach or a little more money anxiety slash retail slash human level checkbook kind of level would be good. So my first question to you would be, when it comes to money, do we have to have anxiety tied to it?
Well, these days it looks like we do. But, you know, anxiety gets a bad rap, but there's a lot that's good about anxiety, too. So people that tend to be a little bit more anxious about money, they also tend to be better planners. Now, you can go overboard. There's plenty of room to absolutely make mistakes because you're too anxious about money. But a little bit of anxiety is a good thing. It puts the brakes on spending. It helps people save. It helps people plan. All these things are associated with anxiety.
I see. So it can be used as an impetus, if you will, if we don't let it get too big.
All of our emotions really have some sort of evolutionary purpose. There's a reason why we get angry. There's a reason why we get happy. And there's a reason why we get anxious. And anxiety is sort of like the planning emotion. And it helps people to figure out what they need to do. They, you know, worry about and plan better when they feel like there's this emotional impetus to do that. So the problem is that we are already a more anxious population than we've ever been before. Google searches that include the word anxiety have doubled in the past 8 years. 3/4 of Americans endorse feeling more anxious today than they did 10 years ago. Especially our younger generation, they're already more anxious. So we're dealing with a base level of anxiety that's higher than it's really ever been before, which means that when you add on any other sort of anxiety, including money anxiety, it can kind of like tip you over the edge a little bit, and that's when people start getting irrational.
Okay.
So the short answer really is that a little anxiety is a good thing. It helps people plan. A lot of anxiety is problematic because people tend to go one of two ways. They either freeze up and do nothing. That's the head in the sand group.
Right.
That just say, you know, I can't deal with it. And they pretty much just go into denial and pretend nothing's happening. The other group that's kind of overwhelmed with anxiety, what they do is they try to over-control things. So they become overly involved, overly controlling, and that's when we see a lot of people make mistakes with money.
That makes sense. And I have to admit that I kind of identify with both of those scenarios because there's been a time when I've looked at my personal landscape and just saw a mass of trees as a forest and not a whole bunch of little trees that I could pick off. I mean, you know what I mean? And so sometimes it feels like almost overwhelming at times. I mean, have you experienced something that has worked when faced with such an obstacle?
Well, actually, you alluded to it earlier, which is that if you can take that forest and break it down into one tree at a time, that helps so much. So I think what tips people over the edge is when things seem insurmountable. Things seem insurmountable when they're looked at really collectively. So if you can break things apart, compartmentalize, you know, as much as possible, like pick off one tree at a time to continue with your metaphor, that is so helpful. looking at the big picture, I think getting help, like getting a financial planner or getting some sort of financial advice, you know, having somebody give you that you can kind of offload some of your anxiety to. So, you know, once you get somebody else involved in the picture, then you can kind of say to them, or you can say to yourself, I'm going to let that person do some of my worrying for me, and then I can just stick to my plan. Because the key is that once you get a plan and you put it in action to help you deal with money, then people, you know, then you can forget about it. You can, you know, just implement your plan. It's when people start feeling like it's out of control, that's when their anxiety increases, and that's when they either start going into denial or become over-controlling.
Right. I was starting to feel a little calmer just listening to your answer right there, because you're right. Once you once you put it on a piece of paper, you have your plan, and you stick to it. That's what you said, stick to it. Then you can see your anxiety level kind of drop a little bit, and because you feel like, okay, well, at least I have this, and so you can. I totally follow where you're coming from. But before we continue, I want to reiterate, we're talking about metaphoric trees. We don't want tweets or emails. Kit and I both really like trees. Okay, just want to make sure we're clear about
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
But you kind of touched on something that was kind of a follow-up question. What do other people do, say, to make more sound decisions? We've talked about the organized approach to things, getting advice from financial advisors. That may well be enough, but would you say the long tail there is just sticking with it?
You know, there's a study that just came out that I love, 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 and it shows that people make better purchasing decisions, because that's, you know, I study what people, how people spend their money more than anything else, that people make better purchasing decisions when they imagine themselves a year down the road. And I think that that would help, too, that if people kind of look at themselves in the future, it's both calming and motivating at the same time. The antidote to anxiety, pretty much always, no matter what kind of anxiety you have, is control. So feeling a sense of control. So to your point, just putting things on paper and pencil, having a plan, having something you're going to do every day so that you can just forget about the big picture and just implement your plan. That really, in effect, what you're doing is you're giving yourself control. You know what's going to happen. You're doing everything you can do, which allows you to forget about the things that you can't control. And that's kind of part of the, I think that's the part of the solution to anxiety as well, is to understand what you can control and what you can't control, figure out what you can do, do it, and then move on.
All right. I have a mea culpa coming up, but first I want to remind everybody we are speaking with Dr. Kit Yarrow. She's an award-winning consumer psychologist and a professor and an author, and she's based out of Golden Gate University here in San Francisco. Okay, personal front page. I dedicated myself to not doing any online purchasing this week. Until this morning, I was able to stick to it. Almost 4.5 days, Kit. I need help. How can I help myself?
What happened this morning? Well, tell me what happened.
Well, look, sometimes between hits in the studio, I'm on the morning show, and sometimes I have a little time to click around on the interwebs, and there was a great deal on a bracelet that I'd been looking at for a while. I was like, oh, okay, well, this one's $7 off, which covers the shipping and handling for it, and it can get here by next week, so I'm going to go ahead and click on it with my PayPal One purchase, which is so easy, and it separates me from my money with quickness. And I feel kind of bad about that. I'm having buyer's remorse in a way. I'm going to be happy when it lands, but I feel bad that I set that goal and didn't meet it. Do you find that to be common, or am I just one of those rare, unique snowflakes that keeps the internet going?
It's absolutely okay. I mean, I think everybody does this. There's two things that come to mind. One is your emotional reaction to it. So I think that if you set a goal for yourself and you don't meet it, that that's more, in many ways, more psychologically damaging than the money that you spent. And so, the reason why you feel bad is because you dishonored yourself in a way. Oh, that sounds so harsh, doesn't it? But
I feel
so
like
that's motivation for you to not do it in the future. The reason that we feel those emotions is because they help us be better in the future. So I what I would recommend is giving yourself a little bit of a break this time and understanding that either you set too ambitious of a goal and, you know, maybe next time tell yourself you're not going to buy anything for 3 days or 4 days or whatever, or remember how you felt when you set your 7-day goal and don't do it the next time. It'll be easier for you to not do it because you'll remember how you felt before. The other thing that comes to mind is, you know, and I think you actually alluded to it really perfectly, is that the easier it is to buy something, the harder it is for us to resist. That, you know, you talked about how you were able to make that purchase really seamlessly and easily, in one click, and boom, it's all over with, and then mm-hmm. you feel bad. I usually recommend to people that they don't use one-click ordering, that they force themselves to re-enter their credit card number or, you know, log into PayPal or whatever they need to do, but give themselves a few steps between the impulse to purchase and the actual buying of that product. And sometimes what that means is putting some payment hurdles in their path.
Right.
So sometimes all it takes, honestly, is 20 seconds for people to change their minds or to reorganize their thoughts on whether or not they want something. But, man, we don't even have to wait a second to get something today.
No, it's instant grat. You're totally right. And the 20-second delay right there helps you pump the brakes and reconsider what you're about to do. Also, I've taken to giving myself warnings on my phone, if you will, or reminders. Let's call them reminders. Like, I'll tell Siri, hey, remind me tomorrow not to buy something on Amazon or not to buy something online. And I'll get that notification to my phone the next morning. And I know that sounds compulsive in a way, but at the same time, it's keeping me from being impulsive.
Yeah, exactly. So next time you're on Amazon, make yourself put in your credit card number by number instead of just one-click ordering. And it's the craziest thing when I watch people shop. I'm not kidding. Sometimes within 5 minutes after telling me that they want to buy something, they'll have forgotten what it was they want to buy.
Ooh. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's true of everybody. We see, we want, we get excited, you know, autonomic nervous system arousal, all that stuff. It really impedes our ability to put the brakes on things. I mean, the way that online shopping is designed today is really to the advantage of the retailer, not the consumer. It is absolutely designed to make impulse purchasing super easy. And so I think consumers that want to do less of that, they have to find little roadblocks they can put up in the way.
All right. Let's look at your 5-minute delay there from somebody saying they want something and then 5 minutes later not being able to remember what it was. And look at what was on your Twitter feed this morning. I was looking at people who have clothes in their closet that still have the labels on them. What's the backstory there?
I know. I'm writing a new column for Time, and it's the science of why we, and then I put in something that people do that they're usually confused about. So today's was the science of why we buy clothes we don't wear. And in my research, I find this in almost every closet I go into, that people have clothes with the tags on. So there's, I think, 4 main reasons why people do this. There's either a flaw with the product that's overcome by something wonderful about the product, and then that it was also on sale.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's kind of a flaw with our perception of ourselves. So, so we kind of imagine ourselves maybe having like a lifestyle that really isn't our lifestyle. Like, you know, we're that yachting, cruising type of gal.
Right.
We're the camping kind of guy or something like that. Part of the reason people love shopping is that it's an exercise in fantasy. You know, we imagine ourselves doing whatever that thing we're thinking about buying goes along with, and how people will look at us while we're doing that. And it just can seem really enticing. And so we go ahead and make that purchase, and then we never actually do go to that black tie dinner, and so we don't end up wearing that outfit. And then we have people, this is the oddest thing, but it's sort of sweet in a way, that people will buy things and then they love them so much they can't get themselves to wear it for fear something will happen to it. So one of the women that I interviewed, she had the cutest little white halter dress. She had never worn it. She just gushed over it. It's so perfect. It's slimming. It's comfortable. I love it, love it, love it. But I don't want to wear it until I'm sure that I'm going to get maximum value out of it, because I could spill something on it.
Mm.
And, you know, and like many people that delay wearing things that they've purchased, you know, she had a childhood where she really was kind of deprived. And so people that have suffered deprivation or loss, you know, they're usually the ones that are really hesitant to actually enjoy things that they've purchased for fear that, you know, something will happen to them. The last category is kind of my favorite. There's a lot of people out there that do online shopping when they're drunk.
Ooh, we used to call it don't drink and prime.
Do not drink. Perfect, Jason. I love that. Yeah, so drunk or high, there's things in people's closet that they've purchased under the influence. And the thing to do, I think, in all of these cases is make sure you can return anything kind of iffy, especially if you're shopping drunk. You know, just make sure that there's an out for that. And then really kind of think about your lifestyle, whether or not And your figure, you know, a lot of people buy things for, like, their slimmer self down the road after that diet kicks in, and they never really get there. Or even more commonly, they do get there, but then they don't really like what their plump self picked out for them earlier. They want to pick out their own stuff. So
the one thing my wife hates is some people buy for their slimmer selves, as you mentioned. I always buy for my taller self, and she's like, we have to adjust every one of your pants that arrive. They all go to the cleaner so they can get altered. Okay.
Kit,
Kit, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Oh, my pleasure. I enjoyed it. Love you, Jason.
That was Kit Yarrow. She is an award-winning consumer psychologist, a professor, an author, a consultant, and a speaker. Her home base is Golden Gate University here in San Francisco. Dr. Yarrow is a frequent contributor to the New York Times, and she has a new column at Time Magazine. If you want to follow her on Twitter at GenBuy. That's at GenBuy. For links to her expertise, check out Facebook.com/Techonomics Radio. Coming up after this short break, we look at what now seems to be an obvious outcome of the increasing acceptance around the use of recreational marijuana, the breathalyzer or weedalyzer. From ground zero of the pot movement comes new law enforcement technology. Remember, buzzed driving is the same as drunk driving, and the Highway Patrol is watching for both. I'm Jason Middleton. This is Techonomics. Please come on back for more.